Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And as a little bonus, we usually don't have the content days kind of line up with the day of the week, especially when it comes to the 4th of July. I mean, 4th of July sometimes on weekends and so forth. But we always give you the original Declaration of Independence that came from Thomas Jefferson. And what we're going to do this Friday is we're going to do that same thing. And so, you know, again, because it doesn't line up all the time, because Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday is usually when I do the shared content with Tammy, and prior to that it was Paul Venable. And so what we want to do is make sure you know that prior to the sun setting, because on the East Coast this show airs at 6 o'clock and well in advance to even people having or finishing their dinner and beginning to imbibe themselves on Friday on the West Coast, or they may be well into that process, depending on, you know, their hardiness and partiness. Anyway, as we go through this on the show, it'll be well in advance to the fireworks. This way, you can understand the political correctness and this wokeness. You know, it's been around a long time. As a matter of fact, when you lived in a society that had the ability to challenge, if you impugned a person's character, you could challenge that person to a life-ending duel, you kind of learn how to speak more nicely and less aggressively, especially if you didn't care to hone your skills in a duel or what have you. So anyway, and you got to remember that in a duel was a more civilized way of basically standing up for your honor, defending a man's honor. I don't know if women had duels, but I would think that, why not? I mean, don't women have honor? Can't women basically stand up to another woman and say, how dare you impugn my character? And so I challenge you to a duel. So let's look at it this way. We, as Neanderthals, or I should say as early day citizens, we would just go fist to cuffs. And when somebody would make an accusation or what have you, you know, unless you're a hardened criminal or somebody that is completely possessed, like, you know, Cain and Abel, then what we evolved into, and if you probably look at the history of this, it was later on in society where this concept of doing this in a very formal process instead of basically jumping somebody, you know, and, you know, stabbing him in the back, shooting him in the back, or what have you. If something escalates to a point that requires a physical altercation, then the civil way of basically dealing with this is in a duel. So the question is, as society at the point of enlightenment in early America, at this point in time, at the days of the Constitution, I believe most of the states actually it was still legal to challenge somebody to a duel. It wasn't until later on where they started saying, you know what, we're going to start making this illegal. And I believe in New York, when Hamilton was killed, they had to get on a boat and, you know, cross over to an island that wasn't considered in New York when Aaron Burr basically shot Alexander Hamilton. Now, I'll just say a subject matter expert on this. But bottom line, as we, you know, kind of look at society, why did we basically, you know, expunge that process? Why didn't we maintain that? I mean, if there's a better way, because everybody, I think, started being gravitated towards court and into court. And it's not like you couldn't go into court then. It is instead of going to blows when somebody has infuriated you, you had a right as a person to take it to a higher level. And bottom line, as we can see with the courts and everything else, I mean, maybe we need to revisit the duel and bring it back. I'm just saying, folks, as a matter of fact, I wasn't necessarily the first person on this bandwagon. I was interviewed by a radio show host out of San Francisco, and he kind of threw it out there. This was like about 10 years ago. And so there's merit in this. I've just kind of pointed this out. But anyway, our content has kind of changed, and let me get through the obligatories, and then we will kind of tell you how the lineup is, because over the past couple of months, it's been in discovery mode as we've been going through the state nationalist little, you know, if you want to call it a brochure or their little pamphlet of key documents, where there was really nothing there. As a matter of fact, I'm really surprised that they didn't cling on to the information that was in the Utah Enabling Act. This was the last document in this little pile of this little pamphlet that they had. And so in the pile of documents in the pamphlet. Anyway, so why is it that they didn't actually read through that and then go through what we're going through? Why is it that they didn't identify? As a matter of fact, if I go back, they're probably looking at the Articles of Confederation and the Northwest Ordinance as something that's sacred. And I'm here to tell you, folks, we've just discovered that the Northwest Ordinance has been used. It was one of the tools Congress used to basically aggrandize themselves, to basically claim that they can diminish the sovereignty of a state when it joined the Union. Now, some of the things we're going to go through is, what, like I said, we'll cover this in a minute. That debt is fraud, learn, pray, and act. As we make our appeals to heaven, we need to continue learning, praying, and acting. Because if we've got mixed ideas, if we really believe the Northwest Ordinance or the Articles of Confederation, if you're still on that, in that boat, and you haven't, you know, bailed or, you know, jumped into the water to swim to freedom, then you're floating in the wrong direction. So learn, pray, and act so that we know precisely what we need. And it's this, I've said this before, the Constitution, the framers of that time basically recognized that the Constitution was a divinely inspired doctrine. You know, what more do you need? I mean, come on, seriously, folks, what more do you need? I mean, anyway, let me not go into the rat holes. So the whole point of what we're doing with this show is helping you learn what needs to be done. And more importantly, what we're trying to do is help you recognize that focusing and demanding full compliance of the Constitution is the only way we're going to save this ship, the only way we're going to save our... And so we have to demand full compliance, and the way of doing that is not just, you know, being the peanut gallery. We have to actually be active in interposition. The interposition process for us, and actually the interposition process going up to the federal government, is pretty much the same. It's petitioning. It is petitioning, and within the petitions, not a petition to court. And just to go down one little rat hole, this last week, I was on a social media StreamYard type of interview. It was about a two-hour interview. And there was obviously somebody that had been informed about petitioning and instruction and really believed that instruction was completely different than petitioning and didn't really understand. So you get these people that cling on to what little things that they understand because it's made sense. And this is where they get convicted. They get this conviction. It galvanizes. I mean, it's hard for them to change their bias. And I made a comment because I saw his little, you know, in the chat room. I said, you know, this is absolutely correct, petitioning and instructing, but it's all inclusive in the petition. And this guy just, I don't want to say he blew up, but he was wrong because he said, no, petitioning and instructing are two different things. And I go, well, if you read the Bill of Rights, and obviously he never did. Obviously, he never went into the debates of the Bill of Rights and why they basically made instruction inclusive. Because if you're petitioning, it's not a request to hear a complaint like you're going to court. In a First Amendment petition, you have a right to instruct them as well. As a matter of fact, if you do your petition thoroughly, it is basically calling them out for their obligation to, for their legal obligation of supporting the Constitution, and then identifying that they have, you know, the Constitution being violated, so now you need to do something about it. And then you basically tell them what they need to do or what needs to happen, because maybe they can't fix the problem, but you need to tell them what needs to happen, and then you do tell them what they can do about it if they can't directly fix it. In other words, a good case in point is if you've got a county commissioner, he can't stop the invasion. He can't go into the congressional, you know, debates and discussions in the House and in the Senate and say, look, we need to call forth the militia because that's what the Constitution says. No, but he can petition the state and get the state to do that, or get the state to at least petition and interpose with the federal government. So in other words, when you petition your county commissioners, I hope this is going to make sense, they represent the entire county. You represent yourself. If you get them to represent the entire county, how much more weight does the petition you have, how much more weight does it have when they actually take it and endorse it and share it with other counties? How much more weight does it have? Because that's something that they can do. They can share this with other counties. How much more weight does that petition have when they actually endorse it and send it up to the state legislature compared to you, compared to who you are? Not that you're not an important person in God's eyes. You're probably far more important than anybody else. However, if they don't know you, then you have no weight. This is why we have to begin engaging government at its closest point to us. Those who truly work for us, those who we have the ability to affect their lives directly. Kind of like what we talked about in a discussion with Tammy coming up this week, because we kind of talk about this petitioning and so forth. Hopefully you start understanding that demanding compliance of the Constitution by using First Amendment petitions for the redress of grievances is the only process. Believe me, folks, I have argued this, and it's not like I, you know, came into this kicking and dragging and, you know, kicking and dragging my feet, flailing my arms, you know, having a tantrum. When I hear information like when John Durash told me about, you know, these concepts of grand juries and people, you know, being able to form their own grand juries. You know, I listened to that. I did the due diligence and I confirmed that the people don't have that right. We don't live in the monarchical theocracy. That was a right that was afforded to the British citizen because they had a king. We didn't have representation. So the point was that we would create a grand jury who would represent us. But we actually do have local representation. They can actually create the grand jury. They should be creating grand juries. They should be creating these constitutional compliance committees. We can't assume it ourselves, like the jural assemblies are doing, or like the state sovereigns are asserting, or like Anna von Ritz is, you know, basically going on and on in her writings and so forth. All drivel. You know, if you don't understand the Constitution, you can make some very dangerous mistakes in telling people that you have a right to create your own government now. That's what the jural assemblies are doing. And many of these people listen to Anna von Ritz. Even now, I know that John Durash doesn't acclaim that, but, you know, you walk a very tight line when you start creating a different government. Or when you say, I don't recognize this government and we're kind of organizing ourselves. No, we have to recognize that the Constitution is still the only legitimate document that should be used as governing us. And all of these laws, acts that they've created are not constitutional. That's why focusing on constitutional compliances, because nobody can refute it. I've yet to have anybody that disagrees with me provide me empirical data and evidence how everything that they're doing is legitimate. It's not. It's all fraud. We have to hold them to those few delegated powers and dismantle this Leviathan, this facade that they've created. I'm not going to go on and on anymore about the Electoral College because, bottom line, if you want to get involved, I'll bring it up every once in a while. I'm still waiting for somebody that wants to challenge somebody in their state, such as the Secretary of State or the Auditor, because both of these positions can actually challenge the state legislature to say, you have overstepped your bounds, and actually bring this to light to say, you have changed the process of choosing the president by granting the party to choose. Clearly, the definitions provided in the ratification debates were that we, the people, were to choose our electors. And so this is actually in Why Counties Matter Most. And so because I've already done this, it wouldn't be hard to do the petition to help you. But I'm working on lots of other little things and lots of big things. So anyway, let me dive into this change in content. So we just finished the Preemption Act last week. I started covering the Northwest Ordinance on Friday, and we got all the way into Article 3. So we basically covered the entire Northwest Ordinance on Friday. Today, we're going to wrap up the Northwest Ordinance, and then I'm going to struggle because I have a document that is it's an image of an old print of 1789 congressional record. So this is something that really kind of chaps my butt. Understanding the foundation and the importance of these original documents, these source documents of what the federal government was doing, the fact that we get these shoddy images, I know they were 200 some years ago, but nobody understands the importance of getting these accurately transposed into a good digital form, so that we can cut and paste, so that we can research, access this stuff. By keeping it as images, keeps people from being able... I mean, if you want to get a deterrent in trying to do good research, make it difficult. Give them images so that they have to read the image one word at a time. So that's what I'm going to have to do with this 1789 Western Lands and the Home Department. And we're going to talk about what Congress did and how that kind of laid the foundation of how they were going to move forward in fulfilling their responsibility as admitting new states into the Union. Then we're going to get into the regulating. Actually, no, forgive me. We're not going to get into that. Then we're going to get into the 1820, because we've already covered the Enabling Acts. We covered enough of the Enabling Acts already to lay the argument out that when they did the Enabling Act of Indiana, and that's in Why Counties Matter Most, and I didn't go through it with a fine-tooth comb like I could have. I pointed out egregious violations where the federal government was diminishing the sovereignty of the state by telling them what to do with their own resources. So as we go through this next, the Western Lands and the Home Department 1789, we're going to dive then next, because it's all kind of in the logical sequence. They did this, then they did this, then they did this. And this all, like I said, the discovery started in 1789. Or not 1789, in 1889, or no, it was 1890-something in the Utah Enabling Act, forgive me. So, I'm not trying to make this confusing, but, as I go along, if I find something that really is exposing some truth, then I'm going to dive into it. Now, we exposed how the Organic Act of 1871, how the Organic Act was a huge, egregious violation, but come to find out, the federal government was already well prior to this because of these other things that were exposed now, how they were able to assume these things and how they had already gone down this path of basically making their little land mass of the District of Columbia into a kingdom. Literally, they started doing that, and all of these things kind of feed into this. So the 1820 April 24 Act making further provisions for the sale of public land. That means that they were going to possess and control the land after the states became states. This is where they did a reach back and said, we're going to help you, but you have to give us this federal land. And once you give it to us, you can't claim it back. You can't go back. Then they came out with the regulating the deposits of the public money in 1736. This was an enabling act as well, or all through the Utah Enabling Act. I think this was disclosed in the Preemption Act of 1841. As you start at the back end, as you start at current day, or, you know, like the Utah Enabling Act at the end of 1800s, they start citing their documents of how they've assumed these authorities. And in lieu of, or in accordance with this previous act, we're going to do this, because they're using these unconstitutional acts as their justification. Nobody's challenged this. Nobody's been able to refute this. So we build upon this stuff. That's how this is all a facade. Just because nobody's challenged it does not make it legitimate. So anyway, we're going to go through the regulating the deposits of the 1836. Then I'm going to cover Andrew Jackson's basic comments. It was like his eighth and one of his final statements to the Union. And that was at the very end of his presidency. And then Martin Van Buren, as he came into his presidency in 1830, I think it's 1837 when he did this, but he talks about the act of the June 23rd, 1836, regulating public money. So all of these little things kind of started. And why is this important? Because this is where they started playing around with the currency and doing things that they didn't have the authority to do. See, what happened was Madison, after, you know, him creating the bank and created this very ambitious process of paying back that debt. Well, all of a sudden, when Andrew Jackson became the benefactor, he was capable of doing nefarious things with the money. And that's what he did, or that's what happened with this regulating the public money. Anyway, after we do that, after we cover that, unless there's other documents that get basically pulled out or get referenced, then we will then move forward with the sequential process of, now that the Constitution has been ratified, we will start going through some of the debates on what they did, some of the basic acts. I think one of the basic acts that we have to hit is the act for regulating the oath of office. This was the very first act Congress committed to the Republic in 1789. It was like June or July, because they had the responsibility of making sure everybody was under oath. They didn't want anybody to have any wiggle room. Oh, I'm not under oath, so you can't hold me accountable, because it is a legal, accountable thing. You perjure yourself if you do something or you say something while you're under oath, and it's a lie or illegitimate or so forth. So we're going to do, basically, because I'm about half a minute here. Then when I come back from the break, we'll dive into the Northwest Ordinance, but we're going to go through the sequential, these things that are very important for you to understand. How important the oath was is one of those. We're going to go through some of the references of how Madison continually and consistently pointed to the ratification debates in his debates and in Congress to help them understand, these are the documents you must use if we're going to understand the Constitution, because we're up here talking about creating a bill, and we need to know whether that's a violation of how the Constitution was understood by the states at the time of ratification, because that's what matters. Are we in line with the contract as it was basically stipulated? That is what legally matters. And Madison was attuned to that. So we'll be right back after this short break. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. All right. Without any further ado, let's get into the last, four articles of the Northwest Ordinance. We were just covering the third article. Now, just remember, Congress has no authority to dictate how that state is going to be, you know, pull itself together, what it's going to do, and so forth. It can dictate requirements prior to, and that's one of the reasons why, when states started joining the union, when we started moving to the West, some of the requirements of speaking English, some of the requirements. So it may have slowed down the state coming into the union, maybe like California or what have you. But they wanted to make sure that they were Christian. And I believe Catholic was not considered, you know, an acceptable religion for states being admitted into the union. It got to a point, though, and I think maybe that's why the state of Utah wasn't brought into the union until the 1890s, because, you know, they started broadening, you know, Christianity and so forth. Because you've got to remember, in the early days of the union, the concept of Catholicism and the concept of deviating much far away from the Anglican Church was very difficult. I mean, within Britain, it was a part of, it was basically a byproduct, because King James actually established the King's Bible. And the people that had been aligned with the Catholic Church for their salvation and so forth, Britain, this huge, massive, and immediate shift. I mean, King Henry proclaiming that we're not going to be a part of the Catholic Church anymore, he basically just messed up with everybody's lives and heads. Because what? Hold on here. You're going to create your own religion because you want a divorce? This did not go over well, because he did it for himself. And if you know how, you know, the stiff upper lip and stiff-necked, you know, and hard-headed British people are, how stubborn they are, this is why Britain was just being torn apart with all this religious, I'll just say, factions and so forth. So when the crown started actually oppressing these people, they just started getting out of Dodge. That's one of the reasons why the America populated so well. You can't tell me that that was a part of the divine hand of providence in helping populate these colonies so well, with good, well-educated people coming in. I mean, America was in the same age of enlightenment in contrast to many of the other places. So the folks, I just if you look at the grand scheme of how things were coming, there's no doubt in my mind that the desire to get out of Europe and the oppression over religion and so forth, which actually made the free market of Christianity to come here, even though in the days of the Constitution, they still had, because Madison was fighting religious biases. That's what we already read, his remonstrance on religion and the remonstrance on the religious assessments, where you're making these laws to say you can't be Baptist, you can't be non, you know, and non-denominational, what have you. You have to be Anglican in this state. So this this huge paradigm shift was, I can't tell you how huge this was in accepting and being tolerant towards other religious faiths. And so as things started moving forward, as the union started moving forward, the acceptance became more paramount than being different. In other words, we're not accepting that here, like the Puritans. I mean, it took till 1833 for the Puritans just to allow the Jews to openly practice in Massachusetts. And so it took them a little while longer to finally start to open their hearts towards others and allowing them to live there. If you look at how America was, and I made these comments before, America was in a position where it, had we not had the Constitution to help guide us towards an acceptance of individual faiths of Christianity and individual faiths, period, as long as, and this is my point, I believe the acceptable faiths in America must embrace freedom, must embrace the concepts of individual liberty, individual sovereignty, that when you have these hardcore theocracy paradigms, i.e. Islam, i.e. communism, then those ideologies are not compatible with the American government and the American ideals of individual liberty and individual sovereignty. This is why they get a foothold in. Next thing you know, they start demanding and taking away your individual liberties and individual sovereignty and say, it's time to pray. You can't pray, what have you. So this is big. I'm hoping you can see how this whole, in the macro view, how it took centuries to literally start waiting, because, and I've covered the history of this before, and I'm not going to, we're going to get into the Northwest Ordinance. When England was brought into Rome, that was the beginning of their, putting them on the path to their evolution, to creating a breakaway from the Catholic Church, to create the hate and discontent of this new Anglican Church that was being forced down everybody's throat, like it or not. And many, even though there was enough, I'll just say, resistance to it, unfortunately, many people just went along with it. Well, okay, that's what we're, God save the Queen. We got to follow the monarch. Anyway, bottom line is this was all a part of the plan to prepare the earth for the days we are living today, period. So let's get into Article 3, because I know I just started this and we lost time or ran out of time. So Article 3, religion. Now, this is what they're dictating upon these states. Now, this may seem ambiguous, but not. Religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind. Schools and the means of education shall be forever encouraged. The utmost good faith shall always be observed towards the Indians. Their lands and property shall never be taken from them without their consent, and in their property rights and liberty they shall never be invaded or disturbed unless in just and lawful wars authorized by Congress, but laws founded in justice and humanity shall from time to time be made for preventing wrongs being done to them, for preserving peace and friendship with them. So in other words, the federal government was basically assuming this full interfacing, even though you're going to create these states in the Northwest Ordinance, even though these are going to become states, Congress will always be the ones to declare and manage what you have to deal with the Indians. In other words, you're not going to have that sovereignty. Article 4, the said territory of the states may be formed therein, shall forever remain a part of this confederation or a confederacy of the United States, subject to the Articles of Confederation. So bottom line, this is why this was fully superseded, but this concept of shall forever remain a part. No individual, no sovereign has the ability. If you're sovereign, you are not subjugated. And states, by design and by definition of the compact, of the Constitution, states are independent and sovereign nations. How do we get this? Well, we already covered this when we covered the Madison's notes on nullification. We'll get into this again towards the end of the year as we dive into these things, so that I'll show you how Madison in 1834 was helping people understand what that Constitution was and how it was to be applied. Anyway, and to such alterations therein as shall be constitutionally made, and to all the acts and ordinances of the United States in Congress assembled, conformable thereto, the inhabitants and settlers in the said territory shall be subject to pay a part of the federal debts contracted or to be contracted, and proportional part of the expenses of government to be apportioned by them, Congress, according to the same common rule and measure by which apportionments thereof shall be made on the other states, and the taxes for paying their production shall be laid and levied by the authority and the direction of legislatures and the district or districts or new states, as in the original states, within the time agreed upon by the United States in Congress assembled. Long sentence. Basically, they're laying it out that now that you're a territory, you're going to have to pay the debt. The Constitution did not allow territories to be represented. It did not allow territories to be apportioned, which means that they couldn't be charged for debt. So they could put excise taxes, but they did not have to pay or were not involved in the direct taxation. They have to be a state to be involved in direct taxation. You understand that, right? So what they're doing here is they're basically saying, well, we don't have this, you know, we don't have what the Constitution has, and we're hungry for money, and we're going to start charging you. And because you're a territory and because we're really controlling you, you're going to be paying. There's no guarantee, there's no time, there's no parameters in making these areas a state. And I see, because the way it has always gone is if they can do it, they will create a perpetual state. Look at Puerto Rico today. As the Constitution got further confused and as the federal government started aggrandizing and taking on more and more, basically marginalizing states, why is it that Puerto Rico has never become a state? This is because the nature and the avarice of government and those in power want to continue or create this perpetual control over you, if at all possible. The legislature, back into Article 4, moving on. The legislatures of those districts or new states shall never interfere with the primary disposal of the soil by the United States in Congress assembled, nor with any regulations Congress may find necessary for securing the title in such soil to the bona fide purchasers. No tax shall be imposed on the property of the United States, and in no case shall non-resident proprietors be taxed higher than residents. The navigable waters leading to the Mississippi and the St. Lawrence and the carrying places between shall be common highways and forever free, as well as the inhabitants of the said territory, to the citizens of the United States and those of any states that may be admitted into the Confederacy without any tax, impost, or duty thereof. This is one of the reasons why. Because they couldn't do those things. So what they literally started doing was they were literally taking control of the land. This is where the first mention of soil, the first mention of the rights and controlling the rights of that. And even the interesting part was they were at this point in time, because they really didn't have U.S. citizens. The Confederation didn't have U.S. citizens. Each state was its own citizen. So basically they were laying it out that in this area, because this wasn't a state, that in this area, residents were equal, even though they were non-resident proprietors. In other words, they weren't citizens, but they could have been citizens from another state. And so that they wouldn't be taxed any higher than those people there. Whatever the taxes were, they would basically be subjected to the exact same tax amount. Okay, so Article 5. There shall be formed in the said territory not less than 3 nor more than 5 states, and the same boundaries of the states as soon as Virginia shall alter her act of secession, and consent to the same shall become fixed and established as follows, to wit, the western state in the said territory shall be bounded by the Mississippi, the Ohio, the Wabash rivers, a direct line drawn from the Wabash and Post Vincent's due north to the territorial line between the United States and Canada, and the said territorial line, we kind of covered this on Friday, of the Lake of Woods in Mississippi, the middle state shall be bounded by the said direct line, the Wabash and from Post Vincent's to the Ohio by the Ohio, to the Ohio River by the, to the, I think the territory of Ohio, maybe the state, by the Ohio River, by a direct line. So they're basically laying out this map, going north of the Great Miami to the said territorial line, and the said territorial line, and by the said territorial line. Anyway, the eastern, this is kind of confusing how they kind of lay out their directions. I'm not sure about you, but if you've done navigations and so forth, you really learn how to do it accurately. And so today, you know, when you're dealing with somebody, hey, how do I get to your house? Oh, well, you go down this road, you know, for a while. And then when you come upon a white picket fence, you know, you take a right. What if the fence is gone? So, I mean, the way people give directions and the way they did it is not what I would consider the basic standards, but it makes you think of what, you know, how they're creating these delineations. Anyway, back to the article. The eastern state shall be bound by the last mentioned direct line, the Ohio, Pennsylvania, and the said territorial line, provided, however, it is further understood and declared that the boundaries of these three states shall be subject so far to be altered that if Congress hereafter find it expedient, they shall have the authority to form one or two states in that part of the said territory which lies north of the east and west line drawn through the southerly bend of or extreme of Lake Michigan, and whenever any of the said states shall have 60,000 free inhabitants therein, such state shall be admitted by its delegates in the Congress of the United States on an equal footing with the original states in all respects whatever, and shall be at liberty to form a permanent constitution and state government. Now, you got to remember, again, Congress didn't have the authority to admit states into the Union. It's not in Continental Congress, in the Articles of Confederation. They had no mechanism of doing it. So they were trying to create a compact to give them that authority, even though technically, just like why we had all these other amendments proposed to the Articles of Confederation, Congress couldn't do it unless they had the delegated authority, which is why they demanded amendments to fix the Articles of Confederation. Moving on. Provided the Constitution and government so to be formed shall be republican and in conformity to the principles contained in these articles, and so far as it can be consistent with the general interest of the Confederacy. Such admissions shall be allowed at an earlier period and when there may be a less number of free inhabitants in the state than 60,000. So in other words, there needs to be, and when there may be a less number of free inhabitants in the state than 60,000. So in other words, I think that's where they started creating the 60,000 mark. That if you have 60,000 people, you could become a state. Article 6. there shall be neither slavery nor involuntary servitude in the said territory, otherwise than in the punishment or of crimes whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, provided always that any person escaping into the same from whose labor or service is lawfully claimed in any one of the original states, such fugitive may be lawfully reclaimed and conveyed to the person claiming his or her labor or aforesaid or services as aforesaid. Be it ordained by the authority aforesaid that the resolutions of the 23rd of May 1784 relative to the subject of this ordinance be and the same are hereby repealed and declared null and void, done by the United States in Congress assembled the 13th day of July in the year of our Lord, 1787, and of their sovereignty and independence, the 12th. And then they have a map of it. If you go to the, like I said, if you go to Northwest Ordinance in Wikipedia. So that right there wraps up the Northwest Ordinance. Now, as we got basically less than 7 minutes, as we kind of look at this Western Lands and Home Department, right? So that's what we need to go into now. This is a document that I'm going to be posting this, so this is going to be difficult to read. If my reading is bad already, it's going to get a lot worse because we're reading these smudges and these blobs and so forth, sticks and blobs that are out of the congressional. Actually, I think this is the Annals of Congress. And so the Annals of Congress being the very first record of Congress. So what we're going to do is we're going to start off on page 19. And if you notice that actually page 19 has two pages, literally. There's a line in the middle of the page, and everything you see on the left side, because the font is so small, that is actually, if you put it in a Word document, that would become a page in itself, in basic text. And so what we have here is Wednesday, July 22nd. This is 1789, okay? And the section at the very bottom on the left-hand side, or I should say the heading for this next debate, is Western Lands. And then this is what it says. The House then resolved, okay, so Congress knew that they, this is the very beginning, Congress knew that they had to admit new states into the Union. So this is where they basically started laying out how they were going to do this. Keep in mind, there's no mention of the Northwest Ordinance, okay? The House then resolved itself into a committee of the whole a committee of the whole House on the state of the Union. Mr. Bonduit, or B-O-U-D-I-N-O-T, but doing it anyway, in the chair, and after some time spent therein, the committee rose and reported that they had had the State of the Union under consideration and come to a resolution thereupon, which was read and then delivered at the clerk's table, where the same was twice read and agreed to by the House as follows. Resolved that an act of Congress ought to pass for establishing a land office and for regulating the terms and manner of granting vacant and unappropriated lands, the property of the United States. Okay, so what they're doing is they're going to create this office, and this office will basically regulate the territories that are legitimately fall, that belong to the Union. Remember, the federal government can't really own the land. They just are the stewards to help and assist, because the other states are going to be doing their own thing. They gave this responsibility to the federal government to ensure that these lands were properly prepared to enter into the Union as a sovereign and independent state, like all the other states. No caveats. Go read Article 4, Section 3. There are no caveats. Oh, well, they can control the soil. No. No holdbacks, no control. State has full control. Whatever the people give them is what they get. And that is, and that's how they move forward. Anyway, okay, so unappropriated lands, the property of the United States. That the said office be under the superintendence of the governor of the Western Territory, and that the land to be disposed of be confined to the following limits, viz. That the tracts or parcels to be disposed of to any one person shall not exceed blank acres. Wow, that's kind of ambiguous, isn't it? That the price to be required for the same shall be blank per acre. Now, if I remember correctly, one of the things I saw in another document actually made it $1.25 an acre, I think. For you to buy land, you had to be rich enough to be able to spend or spare $1.25 an acre. Anyway, moving on. And that every person actually settled within the said limits shall be entitled to the preemption of a quantity not exceeding blank acres, including his settlement. Ordered that a bill or bills be brought in pursuant to the said resolution, and that Mr. Scott, Mr. Sylvester, and Mr. Moore do prepare and bring in the same. Now, they go down a little bit further on Thursday, July 23rd, and they just talk about these things regarding the territories, but I'm going to get into it because it's all kind of a part of the same thing. A bill for allowing a compensation to the President and Vice President of the United States was read the second time and ordered to be engrossed and read the third time tomorrow on motion. Resolved that a committee be appointed to examine into the measures taken by Congress and the state of Virginia respecting the lands reserved for the use of the officers and soldiers of said state on continental and state establishments in the secession made by the said state to the United States of the territory northwest of the River Ohio, and to report the same to the House, and that the and that Mr. White, Mr. Peter Merlenberg, and Mr. Sini be of the said committee. So they just set up the committee to take care of this said land regarding the Ohio, regarding the Northwest area. Now, the next heading on the same page, we just are just kind of reading all this through, is the Home Department. On motion of Mr. Vining, the House resolved itself into a committee of the whole on the State of the Union. Mr. Boudouint, whatever, I'm sorry, friends, I'm bad with names, in the chair, or maybe foreign pronouncing words. Anyway, Mr. Boudouint in the chair, Mr. Vining, so we're actually out of time. So what I'll do is I'll pick up this Home Department when we start next week. And so at that point, we will then be able to kind of continue through this. Folks, this is 1789. This is when Congress is actually laying out how they're going to fulfill their stewardship in admitting states into the Union. This is important because they go down these other paths when they hit the Enabling Acts to pervert all of this and subvert the Constitution. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.